my mask off for the class or the talk. So if you want to sit far away, there's an air purifier here, there's an air purifier there. I had little signs to hang up letting people know about this in case you're not comfortable, but...
Oh. You're going to turn these guys up. Maybe. That one doesn't go up.
That one's good. Maybe turn those other ones on.
They will not turn up.
Huh. There's something wrong with that one, huh? There we go. We're having some few tech issues here in the Zendo. Getting used to it. Can people hear me okay? Okay, good.
Yes.
And let's see, you can kind of see that the Zendo, somebody want to turn the webcam a little bit so that you can see more of, you know, turn it this way a little bit. It's just the one that's on top of the TV there. That's the little webcam that shows everybody.
I would just turn the TV or something.
It doesn't see. I got a new camera too that will show more. Huh. It's a wider view, but right now we're still using the webcam. All right. Well. Welcome everyone. I will go around and say hi to everybody, starting with the people on Zoom. Starting with Betty and Yeshe Tsoki, Kwa, Gathel, Mark, Marv, Paul, Tyler, Bob, Shoketsu, Erica, Dave, Chris, Drew, Linda R., Nicole, and Sabrina. And in the Zendo, we have Franklin, Susan, Coral, Joan, Cameron, and Anna. Correct? All right. Nice group. Let's see. In terms of announcement, with the whole trying to get back in person and everything, things have been a little crazy. So we have Sagaki Festival coming up this Sunday. It's like, oh, right, we have that thing. It's usually a pretty big ceremony. We'll do something in person here. I have to think about exactly how that's going to go. The chant will be recorded because we don't want loud chant leaders in the Zendo and chanting together. And it'll also, of course, be accessible online. And that is our Festival of the Hungry Ghosts, where we acknowledge unresolved karma, ghosts that might be lingering around in one way or another. But it's also kind of just a memorial time of year. So if there's anybody who has died in the last year, whether you know them or not, or if they've never been remembered at Sagaki before, you can send their name. And if their name has been on our merit list that we read on Sundays, they will get read. So during the chanting, somebody reads the names of all the people who have passed away in the last year, and they do it while we're chanting, so it's kind of cool. So there's more about that in the newsletter and on the website. And if you want to bring, if you're at home, you might want to put some snacks on your altar, if you have an altar for the hungry ghosts. Here we will have, let's see. Now I want to change that. I want that to be on gallery view so everybody can see. Do you know how to change that?
I can.
Yay. We're probably going to need like a Zoom, in Zendo Zoom babysitter. Okay. Right. So put some snacks on your altar here. We'll at least, I don't know. I think we should get some Krispy Kreme donuts. That seems like the bare minimum. Because the idea is that you offer something to the hungry ghosts that they can accept. They're not ready to accept the Dharma. They'll be scared off by an offering of the Dharma, but if you entice them in with donuts, you might be able to get a few lessons across. And then also we have a one-day retreat coming up on Saturday, November 13th, and that will have an in-person component and an online component. So that's a very sweet thing. You can participate full, the whole thing, or part-time. So there's more information on that in the newsletter and the website, too. Anything else I should be mentioning or any questions? All right. Okay, so tonight we're continuing on our 9 fields of Zen practice. We are on the 6th field, which is connecting with the ineffable. And this, if anybody has joined us and isn't familiar with what this is a formulation of Zen practice that I came up with. It is described on the Zen Studies podcast website. The components are Zazen, Dharma study, cultivating insight, precepts, opening the heart. Now we're on connecting with the ineffable, and then we'll be talking next week about mindfulness, and then karma work and bodhisattva activity. So we're getting some good reviews from these classes, that people are finding them helpful as a way to kind of get your mind around practice, not something like a checkbox, like you're obligated to do every single field, but just to help stimulate the imagination so you know about all these different ways that practice can manifest in our lives. And if you want to catch up on any past classes, there are recordings on the website, the Bright Ways Zen website of past classes. So let's see. This field, connecting with the ineffable. Are there any lingering questions or anything from past fields or what this whole thing is about? All right, good. When I went to create these 9 fields, I had been creating lists for a long time in my mind, like, you know, what are all the important aspects of practice? And this is one that, it's like I came up with all the other fields, but something was missing. Something deeper in a way. What is our kind of deeper motivation? So that's what I'm trying to convey with this field. So there's 3 kind of sections tonight. And one is, you know, what are we talking about? What is the ineffable? I'm calling it, in one of my podcasts, I called it the Zen version of God. Zen isn't theistic, but it's not atheistic. And it calls us to awaken to reality and ensures us that reality is actually redemptive and precious and luminous. So another way I call this is it with a capital I. So we'll talk a little bit about what is the Zen version of God. And then why? So what, why, and how? The why does it matter that we cultivate this field, that we try to connect with the ineffable? And then how do we go about it? So first of all, within the first section, I did want to go into breakout rooms. So Tyler, if you are ready to do the Zoom people in groups of 4 or fewer, that would be great. And then we'll just discuss amongst ourselves here for about, I'd say 12 minutes. Let's do 12 minutes. Okay, so like I said, Zen Buddhism is not theistic, but it's also not atheistic. It's just, we don't care about theist, not theist. At the same time, we acknowledge and emphasize there's much more to life than we ordinarily perceive. Much, just, you know, our the way that we usually perceive things in a mundane, sometimes kind of bleak or boring or predictable or whatever way is just like, I don't know, like that's just a fog. We're not really seeing clearly. So this is what is pointed at, where Dogen, this is Dogen from the Genjo Koan, which is one of the things that we read on Tuesdays. And that is, he says, when the Dharma has not yet fully penetrated body and mind, one thinks one is already filled with it. So this reflects our usual way of operating, like, yeah, we got it, we see it, yeah. but actually, the more intimate we become with the Dharma, when the Dharma fills body and mind, one thinks something is still lacking. And this isn't lacking in a negative way, just like, actually, there's a whole lot more that I'm not seeing. So he says, for example, when we sail a boat into the ocean beyond sight of land and our eyes scan the horizon in the four directions, it simply looks like a circle. No other shape appears. This great ocean, however, is neither round nor square. It has inexhaustible characteristics. To a fish, it looks like a palace. To a heavenly being, we'd be up in heaven looking down and they see this body of water, it looks like a jeweled necklace. To us, as far as our eyes can see, it looks like a circle. All the myriad things are like this. Within the dusty world and beyond, there are innumerable aspects and characteristics. We only see or grasp as far as the power of our eye of study and practice can see. When we listen to the reality of myriad things, we must know that there are inexhaustible characteristics in both ocean and mountains, and there are many other worlds in the four directions. This is true not only in the external world, but also right under our feet, or within a single drop of water. I don't know about you, but I love that imagery, and we know it's true, right? I mean, a single drop of water, you can look in there and see organisms, assuming it's not sterile water, right? It's organisms. Even more, you can see atoms, and you can, you know, like, you can drill down, you can go out. The world is so infinite. There are so, and that's just the material and spatial dimension of it. There's so much. So what we teach is reality is amazing and luminous. And there is a, you know, however you want to call it, a more, that which is greater, the ineffable, which simply means incapable of being expressed, indescribable, unutterable. So in one of my favorite books that I quoted from in the podcast on this, by Houston Smith, Why Religion Matters. He says, the reality that excites and fulfills the soul's longing is God by whatsoever name. Because the human mind cannot come within light years of comprehending God's nature, we do well to follow Rainer Maria Rilke's suggestion that we think of God as a direction rather than an object. So in my personal relationship with this, with the divine, you know, whatever you want to call it with a capital I was raised without any particular religious affiliation through my childhood, but my parents didn't badmouth religion either, so, you know, just didn't kind of enter into it. But then we ended up getting to Catholic school. And for a while, I was very, very intrigued. I was very you know, it's like, okay, cool. I believe that. That's great. Jesus sounds cool. I love these stained glass windows. I love the hymnals. I love all of this stuff. But then later, I just didn't believe in that way. I didn't believe in the way that I was asked to in Christianity. So I guess I just thought of myself as an atheist, but I was like kind of a disappointed atheist, like an atheist that was a little, you know, pissed at God for not existing or something, like something was missing. But oh well, you know, you can't just manufacture belief. But then through Zen practice, you know, and I'd probably been practicing for about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. And I served as Shuso for a year. And then at the end of that, you have a question and answer period. And I presented some teaching that I resonated with. And it was, you know, it was really about this kind of this sense that that having seen things more clearly, having dropped some of my filters, that it seemed like, you know, say compassion was part of the structure of life, you know, interdependence, and that it wasn't a nihilistic void, you know, when I really was at home with it, it wasn't a nihilistic void, it was actually amazing. And somebody in the questioning audience, she asked me, she said, you know, Domio, you've been my like poster child for atheism for so long, but it doesn't really sound like you're an atheist anymore. And I had never really thought about it. And I just, I guess I'm not. But that, you know, that didn't mean that that now I had a concept of a personal God or a God that's external to me or something, but I had a sense of a faith in something. And it's so elusive, right? Because even something, But that's what I wanted to just kind of get the juices flowing. And that's what I wanted in breakout rooms to hopefully, I mean, nobody's obligated to share, but if you can, for the sake of everybody, share an experience from your life, or maybe it's multiple experiences or a kind of experience, an experience from your life when you strongly have a sense of something greater, however you want to phrase that, that a God or the divine or the completeness and preciousness of this moment, or I don't know, the strength of compassion, and then, you know, describe what you felt if you can. So let's take 12 minutes to do that. So Tyler, if you would invite people to breakout rooms. And I will. Go ahead.
Then I just started sobbing.
Wow.
And I'm not even sure what was happening, and it was just a very interesting emotional response, because it felt like something very big was happening that I was part of, and I didn't know what it was, and I was witness to it, and it was really wonderful. And it was kind of that appreciation for the things that were happening, the traditions and the culture, and just being in a certain place at a certain time that I didn't have intentions of. It was really lovely. And I get a little teary thinking about it now.
Well, thank you. I hope everyone had a chance to share some. I mean, we didn't get all the way around, and I'm sure each of us has. You can't even really categorize it or get your hands around it. I don't know. When I listen to beautiful music, I just start crying. I just tap into something that's like, I have no words for it. It's just deeply moving. So some of you may be familiar with these terms. Certainly you would be if you listen to my podcast on this topic. So there's different spiritual traditions are categorized as being apophatic or cataphatic. So cataphatic traditions, like Christianity, describe the divine, you know, and celebrate the divine, and, you know, call your attention to and sing hymns about the divine. Apophatic traditions point at the divine, or it with a capital I, only by saying what it is not. And both have their strengths and weaknesses, right? So the apophatic approach in some ways is saying, just like, you know, we don't have, in Zen, we don't have a word for this. We don't have a word to talk about such and such. And the more that we had those kinds of words or language, the more constrained ideas about this would be. We'd be trying to take whatever this is that we're tapping into, intuiting, experiencing sometimes. We would, you know, be drawing, you know, a box around it, or perhaps saying it's over there, it's somebody that we pray to, it's somebody that we'll visit someday, or so we're trying to avoid that. We're trying to avoid the concretization or the deification of this it with a capital I. But the drawback to that approach is sometimes that we forget about it with a capital I. We forget about the greater. We forget that is part of our tradition. We're just like the basic idea is that if you do the practice, if you diligently do the practice, you will taste more of this. And I think most of us have. Like, the more that we can let go of our small self-concern and be mindful and all of these things, the more often we intuit this, the more often we're receptive to it. So our practice does bring us more in contact with the ineffable, but we don't like talk about it a lot. We don't say, remember the ineffable. That's what we're here for. Isn't the ineffable great? You know, which is that's what you do when you go to church. It's all about, oh, you know, God is wonderful and great and merciful, and we're so grateful. So each approach has its strengths and weaknesses. And I guess by including this as a field, I was hoping to kind of, right, we don't have one word for it. We don't have we try not to concretize it. And yet it is a huge part of our practice. Now, in terms of why, I think it's probably pretty obvious to people, but why is it important for us to cultivate more of a connection with the ineffable? And I guess, you know, my favorite author, Houston Smith, in his book, Why Religion Matters, talks about, which I found very interesting, he contrasted like the traditional worldview, which was tended to be almost always have some kind of religious or spiritual dimension, with kind of the modern or scientific worldview, which is, you know, you believe what can be proven according to the scientific method, what you can observe, and so it ends up being very kind of mechanistic and materialistic and that. So contrasting those, traditionally, you know, a sense of spirit was fundamental, and matter came out of that. Whereas in the kind of the modern scientific, matter is all there is. And there might be some illusion of consciousness that arises out of a brain you know, an organic brain for some reason, but it's really, it's just matter. And in the traditional, the humans are the less derived from the more. There's like a bigger, there's a bigger something, a bigger plan out of which we arise, as opposed to we are the pinnacle of evolution. This is it. We're the best. which then you look around and you go, ooh, boy. In the traditional view, there's a happy ending. There's, you know, in some sense, it's going to be okay. Whereas obviously in the scientific worldview, you know, there's chances are it's not going to be a happy ending. In the traditional worldview, everything is pervaded with meaning. Where do we get our meaning in the scientific materialistic worldview? Just what we enjoy, you know,
buy stuff.
You know, so meaning is harder to come by. And in the traditional worldview, humans feel at home. They are a part of something bigger, as opposed to, you know, we're just on this tiny little planet that's just like a pinprick in the middle of a giant empty galaxy. So the thing is that, like, we can't, like I realized in high school, I can't manufacture belief. It's not like we can just, okay, well, let's go back and adopt a traditional worldview. But I think Buddhism and Zen, our practice, can address each of these areas. So in terms of the, you know, spirit is fundamental, you know, we have our sense of the independent dimension or the absolute aspect of reality, that, you know, there's a way that this is a seamless whole. You know, things are miraculous if we just kind of drop our little self concern, interdependence. And in terms of humans are less derived from the more, you know, there's a sense that it's not just about our practice being teachings and practices that fix screwed up human beings. The saying is, without sentient beings, there are no Buddhas. So it's like, there is no awakening and perfect compassion and all of that, except as it manifests in sentient beings. So there's this sense that, like, almost like we have this birthright to move in that direction of what is greater. And that's, it's kind of ennobling and redeeming. And then the happy ending, in the sense that, you know, any being is capable of awakening, and this luminous, miraculous reality surrounds us at all times. And everything is pervaded with meaning. You know, if we can be mindful and appreciative and cultivate gratitude and, you know, wake up to that independent dimension of just right here, right now, you know, everything is precious and part of a seamless whole. And then humans feeling at home, and Smith says, he describes this as, humans are made of the same spiritually sentient stuff that the world is made of. And I feel that's a pretty Zen teaching, I think. It's just like, there's ultimately no separation. We are who we are because of all of these things around us, all of these miraculous things supporting us, coming out of nowhere. I mean, I was just sitting tonight thinking about, like, Zoom tech issues and people couldn't hear and how is this gonna work and how is that gonna work, and we've got Sagaki Festival coming up, and I'd had this sense of, like, kind of like, well, I need some help, universe. Just, you know, kind of opening up to, well, I can't pull this all off myself. So let's see what support, what happens, you know, what unfolds. And it felt like that kind of good sense of liberation there. So, this is, I just want to share a beautiful passage from Dogen, his fascicle Inmo, which is essentially the ineffable, or it with a capital I. He says, how do we know it? And whenever I say it, that is a translation of Inmo. So it's the ineffable, it's it with a capital I. How do we know that it exists? We know it is so because the body and the mind both appear in the universe, yet neither is ourself. The body already is not I. Its life moves on through days and months, and we cannot stop it even for an instant. The sincere mind, too, does not stop, but goes and comes moment by moment. Although the state of sincerity does exist, it is not something that lingers in the vicinity of the personal self. Even so, there is something which in the limitlessness establishes the Bodhi mind, establishes the mind that seeks awakening. Once this mind is established, abandoning our former playthings, we hope to hear what we have not heard before, and we seek to experience what we have not experienced before. This is not solely of our own doing. Why are we like this? Why are we here? Why does it even occur to us to seek some greater meaning, to seek a more compassionate life? What is that? It's it with a capital I. So how do we do this? How do we practice in this field? I imagine there's many ways, but I like to think that it starts with recognizing and honoring those perhaps peak moments, those moments where it shines through, those moments where we feel that we perceive something greater. And, or, you know, to pay attention, what excites and fulfills your soul's longing? In some ways, it's enough just to be asking that question, just to be turning some awareness and consideration toward that question, recognizing it as important. And recognizing this, what the longing, which often can manifest perhaps as dissatisfaction, like why do people have to be this way? Why does the world have to be this way? You know, but that longing, which is a sign of it's a sign of the ineffable, that the very longing. So this is Dogen. Remember, it happens like this, what he described before, because we are people who are it. How do we know that we are people who are it? We know that we are people who are it just from the fact that we want to attain the matter which is it. And in another way, this is Houston Smith. He said, the finitude of mundane existence, the not infinite, the limited aspect of mundane existence cannot satisfy the human heart completely. Built into the human makeup is a longing for a more that the world of everyday experience cannot requite. This outreach strongly suggests the existence of the something that life reaches for in the way that the wings of birds point to the reality of air. So we give this longing, this Bodhi mind in us, this seeking mind, value, credence. You know, instead of just kind of thinking, oh, well, that's just wishful thinking, or, you know, this is some kind of phenomenon of our human being, but that there's something meaningful. I wouldn't feel this desire to seek if there wasn't something to seek. And then, in our Zen practice, it's basically about dropping all views. So it's not, you know, trying to find the ineffable and learn about the ineffable and describe the ineffable. It's, we will be more in contact with it the more views that we can drop. Especially the idea that we are separate from it. That we are distant from it. That it is somewhere else, or we're not capable of perceiving it. That is just a thought. That is part of the fog that keeps us obscured from it. Because it's not only there at peak moments, it's just that we have learned not to notice it. Or it's so pervasive, it's like the fish swimming in water. We're like, what? What? What miracle? You know, it's just, even though it's all around us. So just to close, so Zen minimizes descriptions of it with a capital I, but as many of you know, one of my favorite Chan teachers is Hongzhi, who I feel does celebrate it with a capital I. So here's one passage that I feel like he does. The place of silent and serene illumination is the heavenly dome in clear autumn, shining brightly without strain, gleaming through both light and shadow. At this juncture, the whole is supreme and genuinely arrives. The clear source is enacted with spirit. The axis is wide and the energy lively. Everything apparent in the original brightness. So I'll leave it there for comments and questions. Feel free to raise your hand on Zoom using the reactions button. They'll be more likely to see it, but you can also do it the old-fashioned way. Anybody here?
I had a question around, I guess there seems to be, in my mind anyway,
can anybody on Zoom hear? Okay, so I will repeat the question after he asks it. Okay, go ahead.
So in my mind, I guess I overlap this idea of the ineffable with maybe the absolute, which I think you referred to a little bit in your talk, and they feel like very closely related. I'm not sure if they are or not. And then the other thing was, also was thinking about instances of our experiences with the ineffable as a maybe an enlightenment kind of experience, and more of a Zen kind of traditional way of thinking of that. So just any comments you have?
Yeah. So the question, I think if I got it right, was, well, so what is the relationship between? Would you say? So was the ineffable and the absolute?
Yeah, like how, is there some?
How do I want to phrase that? So I've been talking about it as like the independent dimension of reality. Like there's a dependent dimension through time and space and causation, and the independent dimension is dimensionless. It's just right here, right now, just reality, which has no, is not divided up. I guess when I think about, well, there's another term there's two podcasts that I linked to for this field. And one was this Zen version of God, and the other one was the suchness. So I feel like in a way, maybe the suchness is more points to this, where the essence of it is, if you are able to perceive these two aspects of reality, not just one, not just, you know, the absolute or the independent dimension is where everything's amazing and wonderful, and, you know, the other dimension is where things are boring. But just the two. What suchness is just what is when you drop all the filters and the ideas and you see what is, and it's the absolute and relative are two sides and walking. You know, there's the bodhisattva who recognizes there are no beings and yet strives to save every being. So it's like, it's the richness of both of them together that is the miracle. So in a way, awakening to the independent dimension or the absolute is something that we, as an aspect of practice, we need to do. And suchness, or this sense of luminous, complete wholeness, is what we perceive then.
So I guess, to paraphrase, I mean, they are kind of separate concepts.
Very related, but yeah, I think the suchness has a more positive quality to it. It's let's say it's as cataphratic as Buddhists get. You know, it is like, it dares to say, because you will not hear Theravadins talk about suchness. They are no, you know, like, basically there's this practice and it relieves you from suffering, and that's all you need. You know, this whole idea of like, and then there's suchness, and there's many bodies of the Buddha and all this kind of stuff. They're like, nah. So we're a little bit cataphratic in the Mahayana tradition, I think. And then Tyler, you had your hand up, right?
Yeah, I guess it was just, when I was listening to your talk, I was thinking about how, so it was cataphatic, and what was the other?
Apophatic?
Apophatic, thank you. I just wonder if that's what's led, I mean, so much of what I've been loving about my introduction to Zen Buddhism has been the use of poetry in all their teachings as this way of like, I can't point to this thing using, you know, the direct word. So instead we create this poetry that helps you feel what they're trying to point to. And I just think that's such a wonderful thing. And I don't think it's necessarily unique specifically to Zen Buddhism, but I music and art and everything has been used in a lot of religions of sorts, but I've just found it so helpful for me, which was surprising, I suppose, when I saw this poetry, and at first was really sort of like a little bit nervous by it. And it's like, no, if you just sort of let go, try to figure out what they're actually trying to say and just feel something, it pushes that. Yeah. And I don't know. I just kind of, what you and you're talking was making me think of how wonderful the poetry and art is in Zen. I've appreciated.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that is a good, you know, that's one of the tools that you can use without, to kind of point at it, without concretizing it too much, to evoke it. Got to be something else somebody wants to say about God. I mean, do people find this like if they, you know, may or may not find it relevant? You know, it's not like you have to, you know, sign on the dotted line and subscribe to every one of the fields or something, but, you know, I think, you know, from what I've heard, that this does figure in people's practice. Maybe not in a way that you can really pin down. Yeah. as Susan said, it's the search for meaning. And I guess sometimes I, you know, when I've been in a meditation retreat and I feel like I've woken up from the dream, and then I just feel this immense, like, I don't know, sometimes it's even a poignant sadness for how I've missed, how much I've missed. Qua.
Yeah, thanks. I'll put my, I won't say struggled, but I the idea of personal versus impersonal godness, or what, godhood, or what, no, godhead versus a personal god. And we had a little discussion in our breakout room, which I, was really great. But just to stick to my question about it, it strikes me that the way people, like you were talking about earlier, refer in some religions to praising God and all this, strikes me as treating God as a human, you know, that the qualities that they attribute to God are sort of compassion, loving, you know, these, their actions that are sort of, what's the word, animistic, or you know, they're attributing human qualities to God as a way to kind of conceive of it. And then they pray, and then they're worshiping. And this would apply to like any religion, Hinduism, anything, worshiping these gods. And where in my experience and travels, it's always been impersonal. Isness, pure consciousness, a unity of just non-dual, whatever, ineffable thing, but it's not devoid. It has all those. It's pure. It's like perfection, pure peace, pure beauty, pure love, pure fill in the blank, beyond any possible way to describe it. And so it's not empty of those qualities. It's the opposite of that. It's complete infinity of infinities of those qualities. And so I feel you can have it's the contact with that, or the embodiment of that is personal enough for me. I don't feel that I need to ascribe to it some sort of a form, a name and form that would make it easier to sort of, you know, latch onto or something. So I'm new to the Zen philosophy, but the schools that describe it as an emptiness doesn't strike me. That's not a word I would use. I get void. I get that it's just because it's not anything you can describe. But I'd be curious to hear your point of view on this idea of personal and impersonal.
Yeah, well, now it's 9:02 and we just got into that juicy topic.
Sorry.
So I will make it brief, but I think it's a very fascinating one. And it's one that I encountered very, I guess, in the religions that I've studied, the concept, if you will, the relationship with God that I related to most closely was actually in Judaism. And they have, you know, the God who you don't even say God. It's not God. It's just like that which cannot be named. And so it's like the completely the grand impersonal. But they have two aspects of God. They have that aspect, and then they have the personal. And I was like, okay, now you lost me. Like the whole personal one, like now there's a God who knows my name and he wonders how I'm doing. Like, but I do think there is something in our tradition that points to this doesn't end up being personal in the sense that there's an embodied being out there that wonders about us, and because that's dualistic, really. There's a big being over there and we're over here. But there is an aspect to it that it's only come full circle when we recognize that it has everything to do with this being, this imperfect human being. Like, this being takes part. This being is an inseparable part of that. So it ends up being kind of a personal and like self-healing thing. In addition to being universal.
Sort of like it reflects, it's like the sunlight reflecting off the moon. It makes it, I mean, a relationship occurs because there's that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, much more can be said. So I will just close with our verse, abiding in this ephemeral world. Well, no, wait. On Tuesdays, I say, let's dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you.
I thank you. Great.